Our third case this morning is 2020-1429, the State of Ohio versus Donovan Asher Nicholas. For the appellant, Mr. Hackett.
Chief Justice O'Connor, counsel, may it please the court. 3 minutes for rebuttal, please. Terminating juvenile court treatment options for a severely ill 14-year-old child like Donovan in favor of a life sentence in adult prison is a profound and inherently difficult decision for anyone to make. Ohio's transfer statute tells judges what to consider in the form of factors, but it does not tell them how certain they must be in this all-important judgment. This appeal asks whether that design adequately protects against wrongful transfer decisions. And to answer that question, Your Honors, we ask that this court apply the same...
Doesn't it tell them how certain they need to be? It says it needs to the factors in favor of transfer need to outweigh those against. Outweigh is a pretty easy to understand concept. It means one's more than another, right?
It does say outweigh, Your Honor, although I don't know that it says outweigh by how much. I think
doesn't the fact that it doesn't say outweigh by anything other than outweigh mean it just needs to outweigh? If someone weighs 200 pounds and someone weighs 199 pounds, the person that's 200 pounds outweighs the other person, right?
I think the issue, though, in this case with this statute is that we have a number of factors that list in favor of transfer and then also factors that list in favor of retention. And this court has said that it is not a mechanistic tallying and a numbering. And so courts need greater guidance on how much evidence needs to be presented in order to show that a child cannot be rehabilitated. Now, to Your Honor's question, I think outweigh, as we noted below, may suggest a preponderance.
Isn't that what outweigh means?
I think it does suggest
more,
that,
right?
But no court has held that outweigh means a preponderance. I think that could be an option for this court given the question presented, although if we apply the due process balancing test, I don't know that it goes far enough considering the interests that are at stake. And so, Your Honors, at the outset, though, I would like to clarify two more antecedent matters given the state's presentation raised in the state's briefs that I think are easily resolved. Now, statutory factors are not standards of proof, and this may go a bit to Your Honor's question. Factors tell a court what's relevant, while the standard of proof tells judges how factually supported their findings must be, and the state, I think, conflates these two. Second, standards of appellate review, one being abuse of discretion review, do not dictate in reverse the evidentiary standard that should apply in the first place. The latter is a product of due process balancing. The court in Santosky said that the minimum degree of proof required by due process turns specifically on a balancing of the risks involved in the inherent procedure, in the current procedure, and a weighing of the competing interests. Now, the level of protection as a procedural due process matter does not depend on whether the interest at stake is fundamental, as is required in Patterson. Rather, under Matthews, the question is the extent to which a person is condemned to suffer grievous loss. And the court has said that heightened standards are used for interests that are more important than the mere loss of money. That was in Cooper versus Oklahoma. We submit that the heightened standard here under procedural due process is most proper because the risks involved in the current procedure and of the gravity of the loss inflicted. This court has said that children do have a significant interest in juvenile court treatment, that transfer marks a significant deprivation, resulting in longer and harsher sentences, a risk of physical and sexual abuse and attack in the adult prisons, and perhaps most importantly, most pertinent to this case, a deprivation of age-specific treatment. When considering the interests involved, I think the facts of Donovan's case are very, very important. We take Donovan, he was 14 years old, 5'3" tall, and 108 pounds. Your Honors, he was wearing a glow-in-the-dark dragon t-shirt on the day of the offense in this case. This was a child by any measure. And instead of receiving age-specific treatment for his serious, severely severe mental health issues, he is now at Ross Correctional Institution, which is a facility that is not equipped.
So the court found, in particular, the court finds that because Department of Youth Services cannot offer the specific treatment necessary to rehabilitate the juvenile system cannot provide a reasonable assurance of public safety, and therefore it found that he's not amenable to the rehabilitation. Was there sufficient evidence put on that would bolster or support that finding by the trial court? The DYS doesn't have the specific treatment necessary to rehabilitate this 14-year-old.
There was not, Your Honor. At no point did the DYS representative, Acting Chief Sarah Book, testify that DYS could not offer psychotherapy.
Was there any expert that said DYS can't do this?
No, Your Honor.
So where'd the court get that from?
The court, to borrow from the dissent in the appeal below, mischaracterized the testimony presented. As I mentioned, at no point did Sarah Book testify that DYS could not provide this treatment. And in fact, I think at best, her testimony provided sufficient assurances that DYS could provide the treatment and safety. DYS is a lockdown facility. She testified that DYS has 7 licensed psychologists on staff and a psych assistant available Monday through Friday and on nights and weekends as well. And she testified that a supervisor would be called in cases of after-hour emergencies. That's the process that they have, which importantly is no less to the best of anyone's knowledge, that DRC can provide.
What was the testimony the DRC had, the treatment expertise for something like this?
There was none, Your Honor.
Nobody from DRC came in and said, we've got a whole program dealing with 14-year-olds that murder people. That's
correct, Your Honor. There was no testimony at all, whether from a DRC representative or just regarding DRC's capabilities, period.
Well, what I recall is that the psychologists on the weekend aren't working. So if there is a psychological emergency that arises, they would reach out to the chief psychologist. And if that person was not available, it would be other licensed staff members. And at the same time, there was the difficulty of Dr. Hrinko's testimony that if they could not integrate the personality, the alternate personality that they held responsible for committing the murder, that that personality would gain further power, further control more often, and that bad things will happen. So how is the trial court to interpret that information?
Yes, Your Honor. So to take the first part of your question regarding DYS's capabilities and Sarah Book's testimony, she did testify that a supervisor would be called. That's at page, 158 of the transcript. She testified that that is the process that they have in cases of emergency. Now, regarding Dr. Hrinko's, he did testify that untreated, unsuccessfully treated, Donovan would, of course, continue to pose a continued threat. I think that is logical, commonsensical, and to be expected. But he did, as his final recommendation, say that Donovan would be amenable to this treatment. And at worst, at absolute worst, I think taken together, the testimony left the question perhaps unresolved. But this is exactly why we need greater guidance and why we want evidentiary standards to ensure that courts' findings and determinations are reliable and accurate and to the extent possible evidence-based.
But I think the court was also concerned about the fact that over the system's records for the last 3 years, there was no record of treating patients for this particular mental disorder. So how would we couch that kind of guidance in light of these significant evidentiary issues that we can find that the trial court relied on?
Well, I think part of the issue is that the burden is not on the child to show that he is amenable, but more importantly, and in this particular case, to show that the system is amenable to him. And so that is a significant burden, and we had mentioned a kind of shifting of the burden because of this lack of a standard of proof. And I think Your Honor's questions demonstrate the difficulty and the risk of erroneous decisions either way absent a standard of proof.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Counsel, do you believe the trial court judge abused their discretion based on the evidence?
I do, Your Honor, yes. I think, you know, and we presented this below, not only as a due process matter, but also as an abuse of discretion, the main question being that the trial court's findings were not adequately supported by the record, and decisions indicate that where decisions are not adequately supported by the record, they are abuses of discretion. But it is, you know, inherently an evidentiary challenge and an evidentiary problem, and so I think a standard helps, again, guide trial court discretion, but also to assist in the record on appeal.
By a standard, are you saying that we would create a rule that the state has to put on rather than cross-examine the defendant's witnesses? They have to put on their own evidence?
That's correct, Your Honor. Yes.
For Proposition 1, how did you choose clear and convincing evidence?
Yes, Your Honor. So it is a...
Why not some other standard? Is there a basis? What's the basis?
Yes, Your Honor. So it's a product of the due process balancing test. There isn't. This is an issue of first impression for this court. And so, of course, there isn't a decision on all fours saying, yes, clear and convincing evidence is required, and we've already decided this. Rather, it's a process of the balancing of the interests. And given other comparably important interests that are protected by this heightened standard, as the court said, heightened standards are reserved for interests that are more important than the mere loss of money. When we kind of compare these interests that are already protected by this heightened standard as opposed to a preponderance, which is suggested by the term outweigh, preponderance is reserved for things like money disputes and parking infractions. And so if we're asking ourselves, you know, where in this hierarchy, where along this spectrum this decision falls, I think the heightened, clear, and convincing...
Are you asking us to substitute our opinion for the legislature's?
No, Your Honor, I am not. Now, I know... I'm not. I know that the legislature has the power, of course, to draft these statutes, but the adequacy of the mechanisms is to be judged by constitutional standards of fundamental fairness, and the way that that is determined is by balancing the interests. In fact, the court in Santosky says that as a matter of procedural due process, it is precisely the court's role to examine a procedure to determine whether it satisfies fundamental fairness. And so I do not think that a ruling here, that adopting a standard would constitute any type of judicial overreach. I do see that my time is almost up, Your Honors. If there are no further questions, I would reserve the remainder of my time for rebuttal.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Ms. Napier.
Thank you. Madam Chief Justice, Justices of the Court, my name is Jane Napier. I'm Assistant Prosecutor in Champaign County. This case, was a heinous case in Champaign County. In this case, the juvenile court followed the law. An amenability hearing was held where appellant had competent counsel, and after hearing, the juvenile judge issued a decision stating the reasons for the transfer. The due process was satisfied. The juvenile judge, Judge Reisinger, complied with the statutory procedure. She weighed the statutory factors and found that the factors for transfer outweighed the factors against transfer. That's the current standard juvenile courts must follow. It's clear it's a balancing act and should remain a balancing act.
Now, he had no prior record, correct?
He did not.
And it was a definite diagnosis of DID?
Actually, I believe that the first discussion about DID was by Dr. Horenko. I don't think there had ever been a prior to the act diagnosis. And I think that complicates this case somewhat. There's no treatment plan outlined for him. There's no understanding of what mental illness he has or doesn't have. This was basically came about when he's calling 911 saying somebody else did the crime. So Dr. Horenko, in investigating it on behalf of the court, under the statute, then said he may be suffering from DID, and even though Dr. Ringo didn't have any specific personal knowledge of and hadn't treated anyone with that, using the educational materials, he found that was that fit what Donovan Nicholas was saying to him.
Does anybody dispute that this child had this mental illness?
Well, not before the court in this juvenile matter. Later on, that was found that he may not have DID, and that in testimony in the adult court is that he then stated that the final kill shot in using the firearm was actually him. So there's still that there, but in looking here, the court looked at a lot of factors. There was a lot of evidence presented to the juvenile court. There was the violence of the act. There was a premeditated nature of the act. The fact that they lived in the same household facilitated the act, that he basically stabbed his mother in the face, in the neck, in the chest, in the back, over 60 times, took a break because he was kind of tired from doing all the stabbing. And when she was trying to crawl up the stairs, he went ahead of her, loaded a gun, and then shot her.
Counsel, I don't think anybody disputes that the act is horrible, but why didn't the state choose to put on any evidence that the juvenile system wasn't equipped to deal with the situation?
I believe that the state knew what the evidence was going to be. This was a stipulated process. We talk about burden of proof and the burden of going forward, but here the party sat down. The report of Dr. Rinko was stipulated by the parties as it was written. They were aware that a DOIS representative was going to be discussing that. All that information was given to the prosecution as well as the defense. So everybody was aware that there were some issues at DYS for this. And again, with Dr. Renko's report, there were a lot of contingencies, a lot of conditions, a lot of limitations, and it was going to have to be, in his estimation, a 24/7 type of response for him.
So was Dr. Renko, over to your right, was Dr. Renko actually hired by the court, or was this was he hired by counsel for the child?
I believe he was hired by the court. He had first looked at the competency, and Dr. Renko is a regular court-used competency evaluator, and I believe the court used him to investigate the amenability on behalf of the court.
And so essentially the state could rely on or not rely on what the doctor posited?
Yes.
But did the state offer any other evidence of its own?
We offered, of course, we have testimony of 911, the dispatchers, law enforcement, about the crime itself.
But, well, and I understand.
But not on the diagnosis.
Right, and I understand the seriousness of the crime does affect the likelihood that the child would be bound over to the adult court. But, you know, to that question, did the state offer any other evidence?
I believe we just offered evidence on cross-examination, which in fleshing out the report of Dr. Renko and also from the DYS representative.
And those witnesses were originally the court's witnesses or the defendant's witnesses?
I believe that DYS representative was that was offered by the defense.
All right. Thank you.
I believe, contrary to the appellant's contention, no lower courts are seeking any guidance or are confused by their duties. I think, like here, juvenile judges are taking a serious look at an in-depth, individualized assessment, which I think squarely fits under discretionary transfer. I think, unlike mandatory transfer, where you aren't looking at an individualized assessment, children who are 14 and 15 in commission of crimes get the ability to have the court look at amenability and danger, and if they're a danger to society. That is certainly important, and I think that the court here correctly decided and didn't abuse their discretion. I think that even though the appellant is talking about clear and convincing evidence as a proposed standard, much of their brief talks about they'd like for this court to focus on Dr. Hrinko's conclusion. And maybe not the whole report, because I think the whole report is not unequivocal. I think there is some issue, and certainly, as happens in court cases, sometimes witnesses get fleshed out, their testimony gets fleshed out, and sometimes, like with Sarah Book's testimony for DYS, who's there to speak about DYS's treatment options, couldn't guarantee the court that they could meet what Dr. Hrinko was saying was very important, or bad things would happen. Clearly here, there was not only was Heidi Taylor at issue, but also there were statements of violence for school friends. And I know that in recent history with school shootings, that is certainly concerning to juvenile courts as well.
So one more question. If we kept these factors in place, I mean, obviously they're there in the statute, but if we, just hypothetically, if we were to say that apply clear and convincing, couldn't we just apply them to the framework that's already there in terms of when the court's finding factors that mitigate or work against, could clear and convincing be layered over that as a matter of constitutional principle?
I think clear and convincing, with those statutory factors, it would be very difficult, practically speaking. So here, the juvenile court kind of sets forth what is, in essence, clear. It's pretty clear that this the victim suffered incredible harm, that the relationship.
His stepmother, right?
Yeah, that facilitated this, that he was a principal actor, that he was emotionally mature. Those type of things, you know, trying to deal with clear and convincing evidence to each one or as a totality of the circumstances.
Well, doesn't that go to weight, though?
I think it doesn't. I think where it seems to fit is weighing it at the discretion of the juvenile court judge. I think that's better than kind of picking as to what is clear and convincing and what may not fit. I think we'd still be in the same position of abusive discretion or is it really clear and convincing? I think
taking what Justice DeWine said, either you're 199 pounds or you're 200 pounds,
right.
You know, with these factors, not every factor is going to apply.
Right.
But if we were to say, when you apply that factor, it needs to be clear and convincing based on the evidence in front of you, and then that would sort of winnow away for greater certainty about what the balancing actually was. We might get closer to that certainty of 200 versus 199. Any thoughts on that?
I think that in doing that, we are overhauling a system that seems like it's working. I think here, and in my final thought, as I do want to share time with the Solicitor General's office, that this tends to, this works. And here, it worked. And I think in the myriad of case law that is out there, and pretty much every court is rejecting the clear and convincing standard because it looks at trial court judges and are saying that they're doing good work, that they're deciding what has more weight and what doesn't based on what's presented to them at the time.
But then, so if you're trying to prove that he's not amenable, is it your burden of proof? Or is there no burden of proof?
I don't believe, I think with the Balancing Act, I don't think it's, we have the burden of going forward and putting on what our motion is saying, but I think it's a Balancing Act. I think it really, there isn't a burden to the state, to that certainly, we're gonna be the ones that are asking for it, but when the trial court gets that information, they're going to weigh it without a burden one way or the other.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
All right. We'll bring Mr. Peterson forward.
Chief Justice O'Connor, and may it please the court. Before answering some of the court's questions, I want to make three quick points about why the court should reject Nicholas's argument. First, he ignores this court's precedent. Second, he ignores U.S. Supreme Court precedent, namely Medina v. California and Breed v. Jones. And third, he ignores the fact that every court to have considered arguments like his, both within the state and across the country, have rejected them.
Breed was decided in 1975, correct?
It was, Your Honor. But what Breed said, and this has never changed, is that the court has never attempted to prescribe a criteria or nature of quantum of evidence that must support a decision to transfer a juvenile. It's an old case, but it has not changed. In 1992, the court decided Medina v. California, which explicitly rejected the Matthews, Addington, and Santosky factors in favor of Patterson's fundamental fairness test in the context of criminal justice. And that test has been applied in juvenile cases. It comes from In re Winship. It was applied in McKeever v. Pennsylvania. And we cite other state Supreme Courts on page 21 and 22 of our brief that apply that same fundamental fairness test. Now, I want to go to some of the questions, Justice Bruner, you were asking about, I think you were asking my friends on the other side about sort of some of the countervailing evidence. And I think that goes to show why we don't need a clear and convincing standard, because courts around the state are applying this abuse of discretion. And what they're doing, and I think there's a decision from the 10th District, State v. Reader, where it said, there is good, compelling evidence on both sides of this case. We can't say that the juvenile court abused its discretion in finding that there was no amenability, but if it would have said the other thing, if it would have said there was amenability on that same record, we also wouldn't have said that's an abuse of discretion. And so I think that the court's precedent in Watson, in Carmichael, in Douglas, they all speak of abuse of discretion. And I know Nicholas would like to argue that that's just a appellate standard review, but that's not right. You have all of these factors. They're in 2152.12d and e, and the court is challenged with balancing, with weighing them. But that is a overarching decision. That's a discretionary decision about how much weight to give one factor or another factor. And in Watson, for example, the court was confronted with an argument very similar to the argument the court is faced with today, that the state didn't put on any expert testimony, and it was only the juvenile who put on expert testimony about amenability. The court said, well, the state doesn't have that burden, that the severity of the offense would be enough. In Carmichael, again, it was faced with an argument that the state bears the burden, and the court said, no, the state didn't have that burden. So I think, Justice Bruner, you asked who bears the burden. I think there is no burden, or if there is a burden, it's the juvenile court. Because if you look to 2152.12c, the juvenile court is the one that's responsible for initiating that investigation into amenability. And so if we're looking at the statute, what the statute says is really the only burden placed anywhere is on the juvenile court. And in most cases, this court has said the juvenile court's discretion is important. And I think that that is what is reflected here, that when you have these factors, some of them are going to be elements of the offense. And if there's an appropriate standard of proof, it is the probable cause standard that the court announced in Iacono, because it's really two sides of the same coin, and it wouldn't make much sense to apply a clear and convincing standard in the amenability context to a fact that only has to be proven beyond a mere suspicion of guilt in the probable cause context. And so if there is a statutory basis for any standard of proof, it's the one that's already in the probable cause standard.
Wait a minute. You mean probable cause in the juvenile court?
Yes, Your Honor, because there's a two-step process, right? There's the probable cause hearing, and the court in Iacono says the state doesn't have to present a preponderance or clear and convincing. It just has to present evidence showing more than a mere suspicion. And so it wouldn't make much sense to apply one standard in that context and then turn around and do the second half of the transfer bind-over hearing in the probable...
But would suspicion be enough to negate an abuse of discretion?
I think that as long as there is... the reason I'm speaking of that is, so let's say one of the elements is use of a firearm under 0.12d. And it wouldn't make much sense to say, well, the state has to prove by clear and convincing evidence that a firearm was used in the amenability context if they only have to show probable cause that a firearm was used. Now, if there was no evidence that a firearm was used, then absolutely that would be an abuse of discretion. And so if, for example, there was no gun at all, and the juvenile court said, well, I'm binding you over, I find you not amenable because you used a gun, that would be an abuse of discretion. And one last point on clear and convincing evidence, and I thank the court for its time. The statute and the General Assembly uses clear and convincing evidence when they want to. In 2152.14e, that's invocation of the SYO, it requires by clear and convincing. And I know my friend cites in his brief a variety of instances where clear and convincing is used. But in all of those cases, that's a statutory standard. So if anything, that shows that the General Assembly knows how to impose a clear and convincing standard and chose not to do so here. It also knows about the history of Watson and Carmichael and Douglas is presumed to act against the backdrop of existing law, and it didn't change those standards either. So there's no statutory basis to adopt either a burden of proof on the state or a standard of reproof. There is certainly no constitutional basis. The U.S. Supreme Court has rejected it. And my friend, last point, has said that on page 6 of his reply, he has disclaimed any reliance on the Ohio Constitution because he explicitly said this court regards U.S. Supreme Court decisions as giving the true meaning of due process guarantees.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you. Well, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honors. A few quick points. The Supreme Court has not rejected this. Breed's forbearance is not an affirmative holding on this substantive issue. Secondly, Patterson has never been applied to resolve juvenile due process questions. This court's precedent makes that very clear, as well as the Supreme Court's precedent, the reason being the very unique place that the juvenile system holds in our criminal justice system. It requires flexibility that is afforded by the Matthews balancing test. Thirdly, Your Honors, a standard here does not categorically eliminate judicial discretion by the juvenile court. And to be very clear, we are not arguing that clear and convincing evidence standard must be applied to every single factor. Rather, it is to the final determination of whether a child is amenable. The weighing of the factors is still within the juvenile court's discretion. And I think a perfect example, I would direct this court to its decision in Eppinger regarding Ohio's previous sex offender classification law, which included very similar factors, but the trial court's decision at the end of the day needed to be supported by clear and convincing evidence. This court's decision in Eppinger explains very clearly how factors, standards of proof work, but then also on top of that, how standards of proof in the first instance relate to standards of appellate review, the abuse of discretion review not being a substitute for the standard of proof in the first place. Finally, Your Honors, I want to note that this case is not just about the horrific offense that was committed here. It's just as much about balancing our desire for punishment with the need for care and rehabilitation of those most vulnerable people most in need. And it's about the legal processes that we use to balance those two valid concerns. It's about how seriously we take those competing commitments, and the due process balancing test gives us our answer. Unless there are no further questions, Your Honors, we would just ask that this court apply the due process and balancing test, weigh the risks and interests, and reverse the decisions below.
Thank you. We'll take the matter under advisement. You'll be notified of our decision. Marshall, will you call a recess?
All rise.